Foster? As you may remember, of course, as we heard in the sermon last week, you may not remember because of our short-term memories. But we've been covering the concept of reverse engineering. And we've been doing that from the aspect of Israel's sin. Turn with me to 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 1. By now, you're probably tired of hearing of the concept of reverse engineering, that we take something apart piece by piece so that we can better understand it, and in this case, we hope to improve it, to see what went wrong with this design so that it can be avoided in the future. So we've been looking at what Paul identifies as five major lessons. And for those who are tired of this string of sermons, this is the fifth of five. And we'll be moving on to other things after this is done. But when we think about that, if we could master these five things, we would avoid everything that Israel had to go through. Wouldn't that be an amazing life to be able to have these things completely under control? We're going to reverse engineer the last of Israel's, what we call, might refer to as, the five cardinal sins of Israel. Turn with me again here as we are at 1 Corinthians 10. In verse 1, Paul says, I don't want you to be ignorant or unaware. And he goes on to say that Israel was given lots of wonderful benefits. They were, in essence, baptized with Moses, going through the sea, the cloud over and the water under them. They were baptized, and there was that special attention from God. Then they drank the same spiritual drink. They ate the same spiritual food. It says they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. They had all the advantages. Shown special attention, given special blessings, given spiritual knowledge. They were handed the Ten Commandments, God's basic law, and they failed miserably, as we've covered. Verse 5. With most of them, God was not well pleased. How do we know? For their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. So Paul says, now these things, and in this case, these five things, these things became our examples to the intent or for the purpose so that we would not, and as we covered in sermon number 1, we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Capital sin, we might say, number 1. Verse 7, capital sin number 2. Do not become idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose to play. Capital sin number 3 in verse 8. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day, 23,000 fell. So we have lust, we have idolatry, we have sexual immorality. The fourth capital sin, verse 9. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Four capital sins. The fifth one may not seem as egregious as the rest, but it is on the list of one of the five major things Paul encourages the Corinthians to learn from. So in verse 10, nor complain. Are you serious? Complaining, one of the five capital sins of Israel, which allowed them death, to wander through the wilderness until they drop dead. Complaining? Nor let us complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. They were destroyed as a result. Well, let's take a look at this fifth of five capital sins that God warned us about through the Apostle Paul, that we not repeat this sin. Complaining. Is it that serious? I love the way the word is used in the King James Version, because it sets a tone unlike the word complaining. You say, I've got to complain about this product. We might have a legitimate issue. I like the word the King James uses because you realize it's not a legitimate issue. The King James uses the word murmur. Murmur. I like to use that word better to characterize what Israel's problem was and what our problem can be, because it's not a legitimate issue. It's murmuring. It's the Greek word gongudzo, and it means to grumble. To grumble. You see, a complaint might be a different thing. Your supervisor at work may say, if you have a complaint, put it in the complaint box and we'll address that. And then they promptly throw all those suggestions away. Oftentimes, I'm teasing. Point is to murmur, to grumble, a grumbling complaint. If you look up the English word murmur, it says this. It's a half-suppressed or muttered complaint. Half-suppressed. It's there. What do we have? We have grumbling. To grumble in the English dictionary means to mutter in discontent. See, if you have an issue with someone, you take it to their face and you say, we have a problem here, can we work this out? But to murmur or to complain, as Paul wrote about, is to grumble under the breath, the discontent. Let's look at a few usages of this word. We'll eventually come back to 1 Corinthians 10, so if you want to put your 3x5 card there, or your Bible ribbon, we'll eventually get back here. But turn with me to Matthew chapter 20. Matthew chapter 20. This same word in the King James, to murmur or to complain in most other more modern English translations, is used here. Matthew chapter 20 in verse 11. Now, of course, we'll give quickly the background about this circumstance. Christ is telling a story here, and he's saying that we have this story of the vineyard. And the owner of the vineyard, and again, Christ is focusing on attitude. He's saying the owner of the vineyard wants to get the harvest in. And so he goes out in the morning, as you know, 6 in the morning, hires a bunch of people, says, come, I'll pay you a decent day's wage for your work. So they start work. He goes out at noon. The owner goes out again at noon because he sees we're not going to make the harvest here in time. And literally, this can be the case in some grape-producing areas. If you don't get the harvest in that day, a frost sets in that night and ruins the harvest. So he goes out at noon, he hires a bunch more people, says, I'll pay you what's right. Then he goes out at 3 o'clock, and again he has to hire more. And finally, 1 hour before sunset, he still has to hire individuals to get the harvest in. And they go through the pay line at the end of the day, and the ones who worked, as you know, the 1 hour, goes through the line first. And they each get a full day's wage. They get a day's wage, 12-hour wage, for 1 hour of work. Don't we all wish we had an employer like that? No, not many employers like that around that I know of. It's usually the opposite. I'll pay you for 1 hour if you give me 12 hours of work. So they get a full day's wage. And you know the story. Everyone who comes through the line gets the same wage. Well, the ones who work the entire day are thinking, wow, if we paid one day's wage for a one-hour worker, we're going to get 12 days of wage for our 12 hours. And they just get their day's wage. Now, without going into why is this parable told, what's the point of it all, that's not what we're looking at here. We're looking at the attitude of grumbling, of murmuring. Matthew chapter 20 and verse 11. Matthew 20 verse 11. And when they had received it, their one day's wage, which is what they had agreed on, verse 10 gives some background. When the first came, they supposed they would receive more. They likewise received each a denarius, a decent day's wage for a decent day's work. When they received it, they complained against the landowner. The other translations say they grumbled. Some translations said they murmured. So they began talking with each other, saying, "These last men worked only 1 hour. Here's the issue. You made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the heat and the heat of the day." They grumbled. They murmured against the landowner. And of course, he goes on to explain, "Look, pal, you said when I hired you at 6 this morning, you'd work for the day and I'd pay you a decent wage. And this is the going rate. This is what everybody else makes. Had you not heard these other things, you would have been happy with this. So don't be angry just because I'm generous." Well, what would we see about grumbling, about murmuring? Well, that is usually, well, we'll talk about a few of these things. Take note of this. Who are they talking to? How is this going? What are they saying? We'll look at it again in a moment. Luke chapter 5 in verse 30. Luke chapter 5 in verse 30. See if you see some common threads in the use of this word murmur or grumble or complain in these three events that we'll look at. One in the vineyard, now another one, Christ's habit of dining with the unclean. Verse 28 of Luke chapter 5. Let's go to verse 27, get the background. After these things, he went out, Christ went out, saw a tax collector named Levi, also we know as Matthew, sitting at the tax office. So Christ happens to walk by the IRS agent's office, and right above it, it says, you know, IRS or PRS, Palestinian Tax Authority, you know, PTA, there it is. And he's going to collect taxes. So he sees Levi and Matthew, and he says, "Follow me." So it was not a scary kind of, he walked by, "Follow me," and Matthew goes, "Okay, I follow." They'd done this. They talked a lot prior to this. So now is the time to start your full-time service, in essence, to the gospel. So he left all, got up, rose up, and followed him. Then Levi gave him a great feast in his own house. Levi was a wealthy individual because he was a tax collector. And there were a great number of tax collectors and others who sat down with them. Now, as you probably remember, tax collectors were abhorrent to most of the culture, because not only did they collect taxes, you know, most IRS agents are not people's favorite individual. Somehow they get blamed. Very much more directly here, an individual who was a tax collector would sign a contract with the Roman government, and they would pay the Roman government a certain amount of money in order to be able to be a tax collector. And then the Romans would tell them, "Here's how much we expect from your area." And they would start collecting. Now, how much they collected was really completely up to them. They said, "Here's how much we expect as a Roman government." So the individual then would tax that amount plus whatever he could garner on top of that. So they were despised individuals because they would often inflate the tax bill, and there was no recourse for the typical Jew. You had to pay it, or you couldn't do business. So not only were they ripped off, but these Jews were collecting taxes for the despised Roman government. So they were doubly hated. So they became synonymous with like the worst of the worst. If you wanted to insult someone, "You're just like a tax collector." That was a terrible insult. The other things that they would say is either you're a Gentile, or a tax collector, or you're demon-possessed. So the three worst insults you can throw out. Christ was called all of those things. So here he has this meal with all these unclean people, these tax collectors. Now again, why would lots of tax collectors be there? Because if you're a tax collector, who are your friends? Not the people out on the street. They like to string you up. So all of your friends are the other tax collectors. So they're all there. Matthew invites them all. He wants them to meet Christ, to see what he has to say. He's excited about the truth, and he wants his friends to become excited as well. Verse 30, the scribes and Pharisees murmured. They complained. They grumbled. That's what the word means. They grumbled about what? Against his disciples, saying, why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? Why are you doing that? Of course, Christ went on to explain that this should be, for you Pharisees, a no-brainer. Who needs, in your opinion, who needs the most help? Well, it would be people like the tax collectors. So why wouldn't you eat with them? Try to teach them, try to encourage them, try to endear them so that they might listen to what is right. People that are sick, go to the doctor. That's who needs it. I'm the doctor. I'm going to have dinner with them. Hopefully they'll be made better over the course of time. So they murmured because they perceived that Christ was doing something that he shouldn't, and the disciples too. But notice who they complained to. Why do you eat and drink? That will form something we should talk about a little bit later. Let's look at the third example of the use of complaining, John 6. John 6, toward this middle of the chapter and onward, Christ introduces this theme, and you might remember that at the time of Christ, it was typical that the Jews felt that the Messiah would recreate the miracle of manna as one of the proofs of his messiahship. So Christ takes off on that mistaken belief, and he says, you're looking for the wrong kind of bread. In verse 41, John 6, 41, the Jews complained about him. They complained about him. They grumbled. They murmured about him. Interesting. They murmured about him. Who did they talk to? Interesting to note. We'll come back to that. The Jews then complained about him because he said, I am the bread which came down from heaven. You're looking for the wrong bread. And they said, now, is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How is it that he says, I have come down from heaven? Jesus therefore answered and said to them, do not murmur among yourselves. Not grumble, don't complain. Then he goes on to say a number of other things. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I'll raise him up at the last day. In essence, what he is saying there is you're not being called and you can't get it. There'll be other things we can say about that. We sometimes isolate that verse for a doctrinal understanding. It's very true. But in the context, he's saying you're just not going to get it. You're not being called. You're not going to understand this. So it goes on to describe that he is the living bread that came down from heaven. Now, it is true that while the Pharisees did not grasp this and murmured about Christ, it became infectious in one sense. And even the apostles had trouble with this. In verse 59, these things he said in the synagogue as he taught in Capernaum. Therefore, many of his disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a hard saying. Who can understand? This is difficult to grasp. We don't get it. What does he mean? Eat my flesh and drink my blood. Verse 61, when Jesus knew in himself that his disciples grumbled about this, he said to them, does this offend you? They themselves were grumbling. They were murmuring. They were complaining. So we looked at these three events where grumbling, murmuring, complaining takes place. Have you noticed some similarities? Well, I think we can. We might deliver a number of points. We might analyze a number of points. We can pick this apart, begin to see what makes up this fifth capital sin that actually caused the death of the Israelites in the wilderness. First point about complaining, I put it this way because I like the word murmur. Complaining has its roots in murmuring. Murmuring. In other words, murmuring indicates this under the breath, half-muttered attack. Look at Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2. In verses 14 and 15, I had to roll this scripture around in my head in the Dallas-Fort Worth airport as Wednesday night turned into Thursday morning. And I was still sitting in the same chair for the last 6 hours, hoping and praying, of course, that the flight wouldn't be canceled altogether and that would become my bed for the night. Philippians chapter 2, in verse 14. Do all things without complaining and disputing, without grumbling and arguing. Do all things, whether it's waiting for that flight, whether it's waiting for the nacho bar to open tonight, do all things without, you know how hard that is? Now, maybe it's easy for you. I find this to be an extremely difficult thing to do. Again, you may not. And now I'm complaining about you because you can do it and I can't. Point is, very difficult to do. And usually, it's not a complaint like, here's a suggestion how to make something better. It's, man, this air conditioning just is not cool enough. I'm so sick and tired of being hot all the time. Whatever it might be. Do all things without grumbling and arguing. Why? See, our goal is to imitate Jesus Christ. Our goal is to be character-wise a carbon copy of God. And one of the ways that takes place is by getting rid of grumbling and arguing. So that, verse 15, that you may become blameless and harmless. Blameless and harmless. The word harmless means innocent. If you want to be blameless and innocent before God, quit complaining, quit grumbling, quit arguing. That spirit of discontent, that spirit of disputing others. Do all things without complaining and disputing so that you may become blameless and harmless. Children of God, without fault, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. One of the ways to become without fault is to quit complaining. Quit murmuring. So complaining has this root system of murmuring. And that leads to the second very related point, I would think. And that is complaining displays a spirit of discontent. Discontent. Now I might say, well, that's pretty obvious. Discontent. If I was content, I wouldn't have anything to complain about. Maybe. Turn to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13. Do you know anybody who should be content and yet still grumbles? Well, I can certainly say then, it's not a matter of being content. We've got lots to be content about, but we still find something to grumble about. I don't know about you, but every time I seem to purchase something over the internet. I always have this habit of looking at the reviews and reading through some of them. And it's, in some senses, it's become a form of entertainment, because each one of these reviews, you see an attitude. You either see one that's pleased and content and happy, and you read the others that are just kind of nasty. Boy, I wonder what it's like living in that household. They write these things about this product, and they're bellyaching about this and about that. Hebrews 13, verse 5. We're told to have a different spirit here. Complaining displays this spirit of discontent. Hebrews 13, 5 says the opposite should be true of Christians. Let your conduct be without covetousness. We might say the first cardinal or capital sin of Israel. Be content with such things as you have. Does grumbling, this spirit of discontent, does it really have to do with covetousness as well? Isn't it interesting that Paul puts them together in the same breath, we might say? Don't be covetous. Be content. Quit grumbling. Be content with such things as you have. That doesn't mean we don't try to improve our circumstance. That doesn't mean we buy better when we have the opportunity. That doesn't mean we replace something that we have with something better because we're not content. He's talking about an attitude, an approach here. A spirit of discontent often is a spirit of covetousness, whereas a spirit of contentment is different and is completely opposite of that. How can we be content with what we have? Because we have what's most important. For he himself, the writer emphasizes, not just he says, but no, he himself has said. I mean, God himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we can be content with what we have. We can get rid of, we can displace this reservoir of murmuring and discontentment with the spirit of contentment. Let's go on to a third as we dissect this issue of complaining. Complaining number three focuses on, and we might say criticizes or attacks, others rather than the actual problem. Turn back to Numbers 14. Numbers 14, I think, is one of the examples that Paul must have been thinking about when he wrote about this fifth capital sin of Israel. Murmuring focuses on others rather than the problem. We'll see that here in Numbers chapter 14. We'll need to back up just a few verses for some of the context. Israel is marching toward the promised land. In verse 29 in chapter 13, the Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites and Jebusites and Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of Jordan. So the spies come back, they give their report and said, man, there's people that live there. Not just any people. What do they expect? Just an empty place? A land flowing with milk and honey where nobody wanted to live? Apparently that's what they were thinking. So thinking there's people there. There's the Amalekites. They're pretty tough people. They got this reputation. There's the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, and the Canaanites that live down by the sea. They're all along the banks of the river. Verse 30, Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. Caleb was the president of the Optimists Club. No, he knew God promised this land to them. And that's all it took for him. God promised it. It's a done deal. Verse 31. But the men who had gone up with him said, "We're not able to go up against the people, for they're stronger than we." And you know what? That was a true statement. It's a true statement. Without God, they had no hope. I mean, you, having been a slave for 40 years, how well trained is your army? Not very well. How are you gonna attack fortified positions in this land by yourself? Well, it'd be impossible. So it wasn't necessarily a false statement. They were stronger. But who was far stronger than those Canaanites? Well, obviously God. So what are they grumbling about? What are they complaining about? How effective is that machine gun nest when it's filled with hornets? Are you going to stay in there if you're the machine gunner? I don't think so. God said he would send hornets into the land to chase these people out. How effective is your sword or your spear against a swarm of hornets? I only had on one occasion that I can think of, was chased by a swarm of bees. So at a preteen camp, one of our little girls had gotten into, she had this little, this kind of sprained ankle, and she was behind the backstop, and the kids were out playing kickball. And so she's kind of walking behind this kickball backstop there. And again, in those circumstances, you come to a camp, and a lot of times there's just not a lot of activity going on at other times of the year, so wildlife just makes itself at home, no matter where it is. So she was walking back there, stepped on a yellow jacket's nest, and so her ankle immediately started to feel better because everything else was being stung. So she is screaming, and she starts running, and we go to help, and we find out that this is a bigger nest than we would have ever anticipated. So we're all getting stung, and we're running with her to try to get her out of the way, and these bees are all... And this is a frightening thing. There's nothing you can do but run. And that's what we did. And she had God clearly intervened. She probably had 60 to 70 stings. Ill effects, and we took her to the hospital, got her iced down. She's just so cute, just as a sidelight. My wife has her in the shower, ripped all the clothes off, and has the ice cold water running on her until the first responders could get there. And just trying to slow all this down, cool it down, keep the swelling down. And she said, "Mrs. Myers, can we turn on the hot water?" "No, sweetheart, we've got to keep this cold going so that you'll be fine." And again, we anointed her right away, and she was fine. But nonetheless, God says he could easily send these Canaanites on the run with things like that. We're well able. No, they're stronger than we. Verse 32, and they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours the inhabitants." I mean, we're as good as dead. We try to walk in the land itself will swallow you up. "And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. They were the giants, the descendants of Anak, which came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight. And so we were in their sight." So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel did what? They complained. They murmured. They believed this report instead of believing God. They complained against God? No. That's usually not the case. They criticized and attacked Moses. They complained against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, "If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness." Talk about an attitude. They're criticizing Moses and Aaron. Basically saying, like little immature children, "I wish I was dead. If you died in it, get over it." Grow up. No. It's a spiritual attitude problem, not a maturity problem. It's a spiritual maturity problem. So oftentimes, murmuring and complaining focuses on the wrong thing. Focuses here on the leadership, the physical leaders, rather than on God. Rather than exercising faith, clearly they were simply looking at the human situation. So they're imputing motives. Verse 3, why has the Lord, Yahweh, brought us into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? What else is a part of this? We might introduce it here, and that is complaining over-exaggerates and misdiagnoses. Misdiagnosis is the problem. It over-exaggerates. No, we're brought out here to die by the sword. Our wives, our children are going to be taken advantage of. They're going to be slain right before us. Wouldn't it not be better for us to return to Egypt? And so you remember the rest of the story. They organize a party, and they're going to go back to Egypt, and they get due recompense for their rebellion. So often, grumbling focuses on others rather than the actual problem. Turn with me to the book of James. James chapter 4, in verse 1. James chapter 4, in verse 1. James talking about an attitude of roaring and fighting. We were told earlier by the letter of the Philippians to do all things without complaining and arguing. I'd like to tie some of these things together. James asks, where do wars and fightings or fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust, you do not have, you murder and covet and cannot attain, you fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and you don't receive because you ask amiss that you may spend it on your pleasures. Everything's focused on the wrong thing. It's focused on self. Verse 4, adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity or hatred with God, hostility against God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. This kind of murmuring and complaining leads to this spirit of fighting and warfare. It is interesting when we talk about how do these fights begin. Isn't there some root of complaint at the root of fights and wars? We look at something as simple as Russia invading the Ukraine. Was there some complaint, murmuring that leads to this? They have what we have, what we want. They've taken it over the course of time. It should be ours. We're going to take it back. We can think about those things. Often complaining and murmuring, we might say always, focuses on the wrong thing. Focuses and attacks others rather than the actual problem. It was Moses and Aaron's fault. God led us out here to kill us, and you're to blame. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 16. We mentioned that a fourth aspect of complaining, as we dissected, is over-exaggerating and misdiagnosing the actual problem. Because it's problem-oriented and not solution-oriented. Problem-oriented, not solution-oriented. So in Exodus chapter 16, we have part of the earlier journey where God is going to give them the manna. It says in verse 1, they journeyed from Elim, all of Israel, And all the congregation of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. So we're basically a month out from the original Passover. The whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured. They complained, they grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. If there was fault to be given, whose fault was this? It was God's fault. But they were complaining about Moses and Aaron. The children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Eternal in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the full." Pause for a moment. What did we just said? Over-exaggeration? Absolutely. They didn't enjoy short work weeks while they were in Egypt. They didn't have many employee benefits. They make it sound like, you know, the end of the day we came in after a couple hours of work. And of course they always worked us in the early morning before it got too hot. And then we came home and there was that giant pot of meat that we could just sit and eat all we wanted. And then bread. Oh my, we had bread, we had baguettes, we had pita bread, we had all the bread we could eat. Just not true. Not true in the least little bit. Completely over-exaggerated. In fact, we might say complaining often rewrites history. Because we've got to legitimize that complaint. So we've got to make the history as bad as we possibly can to justify what we've been saying. So they're rewriting history. They're not just exaggerating, they're rewriting it. "For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." So another matter of imputing motives. Your real plan, you know what? He did. He was raised in Pharaoh's household. He's a plant. Pharaoh put him up to this, to lead us out into the wilderness and just kill us all. I don't know exactly what they said, but it's not hard to imagine that they could have said things like that. Yeah, where has he been the last 40 years? He's been undercover just to sneak in here, lead us out, and kill us all. Verse 4, "The Eternal said to Moses, 'No, I'll rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. The Sabbath is the test commandment.'" So we would give bread on 6 days. Normally, the sixth day, you'd have twice as much gathered, etc. You know the story. "Shall be on the sixth day," verse 5, "that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. Then Moses and Aaron said to all the children of Israel, 'At evening you shall know that the Eternal has brought you out of the land of Egypt.'" It's not me, it's not Aaron. Verse 7, "And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Eternal." It's an interesting phrase. The manna, which they came to protest. Spoke those words. We detest that manna. That manna represented the power of God, the glory of God. He's a miracle-working God. "You'll see the glory of the Eternal, for he hears your murmuring," your complaints, your grumbling. You coming to me to complain about these things? You know who's listening in? God himself. So you misdiagnosed the problem. The problem is not food. The problem is not lack of food. The problem is not lack of water. The problem is not bad leadership. The problem is your attitude. Now, over the years, the Church of God has taken a certain amount of criticism because you people are always talking about attitude. Well, he's got a bad attitude. Well, all these things often boil down to, what is our attitude like? Is it a right attitude of faithfulness toward God, of faith in God, faith in God's providence, faith in his works, faith in his action? Or is it a complaint against God? Moses said, he hears your grumbling, your murmuring, your complaints against the Eternal. Now, now, up to this point, they didn't complain directly to God. See, it's God's fault. They're blaming Moses. But Moses is saying, no, you're complaining to God. You're complaining against God. What are we, he says, that you complain against us? We're just instruments. Verse 8, Moses says, this shall be seen when the Eternal gives you meat to eat in the evening and the morning bread to the full. For the Lord hears your complaints which you make against him. Now we begin to see, as we dissect this, its relationship to the other four of the capital sins of Israel. It is displeasure with God. Why do we lust? Because we're not happy with what God has given us. Why do we worship idols? Because we're not happy with God and what he's given us, how he deals with us. And we can go through the others as well and see that same connection. Or we're involved with sexual immorality. Again, we're not pleased with what God has given us. We want something that he says we shouldn't have. We can go through that. You might do it on your own. The Lord hears your complaints that you make against him. What are we? Your complaints are not against us, but against the Eternal. So complaining over-exaggerates, misdiagnoses the problem, in fact, frankly, rewrites the history. So one might say, you know, this heat is just killing me. But the other says, I am so thankful that we have air conditioning in the cabins. I heard that this week at camp in 103-degree temperatures. People aren't complaining about the heat. They're saying they're thankful that they have air conditioning at the end of the day. Pretty awesome attitude. A fifth thing about complaining as we pick it apart. Complaining brings discouragement. Why does God hate complaining? Why is it a capital sin? Because it brings such terrible discouragement. Not just to us, but to others. Deuteronomy chapter 1. Deuteronomy chapter 1. In verse 23. Start there. Deuteronomy 1. In verse 23. Moses says this. The plan to go out and spy the promised land. Get an idea of what we're up against so we know how best to start this process of occupation. The plan pleased me well, Moses said, so I took 12 of your men, one from each tribe. They departed and went up into the mountains and came to the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. They also took some of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down to us. And they brought back word to us, saying, it's a good land which the Eternal our God is giving us. And if that were the end of the story, that would be great. Nevertheless, you would not go up, but rebelled against the command of the Eternal your God. And you grumbled, you murmured, you complained, interestingly, in your tents, and said, because the Eternal hates us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites that destroy us. First it's hunger, then it's thirst, and now it's the enemies, and what else? This constant song of misdiagnosis, of over-exaggeration, and of discouragement. Verse 28, where can we go up? Our brethren have discouraged our hearts. The word discouraged there literally means melted our hearts. Murmuring and complaining just melts people's hearts. It brings discouragement. They've melted or discouraged our hearts, saying the people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven. That's not like an exaggeration. The walls go up to heaven. God, just not true. Moreover, we have seen the sons of Anakim there. Fortified cities aren't enough. They're occupied by giants. Verse 29, then I said to you, do not be terrified or afraid of them. The eternal your God who goes before you, he will fight for you according to all he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. This is God's business. Don't worry. Verse 31, in the wilderness where you saw how the Lord your God carried you as a man carried his son in all the way that you went till you came to this place. Yet for all that, you did not believe the Lord your God. Begin to see what the root of this sin is. Why did we complain? Why did Israel complain? Why did they murmur? Why did they grumble? One simple statement. You did not believe the eternal your God. Does complaining have its roots in not believing God? Believing God is out for our best interest, that he'll take care of the situation, that he'll watch over us in every circumstance, it brought discouragement. So as you know, we're told what to think about. It's a memory verse, Philippians 4:8. I don't know whether it's true, pure, honorable, right, lovely, good report. Think on these things. One translation says, let your mind dwell on these things. So, as I'm sitting in the airport, what could I be doing rather than grumbling about how late I'm going to get home and not get things done that I was hoping to get done? Well, be thankful that I'm sitting in an air-conditioned terminal. It's 101 degrees outside, literally. It's awfully nice to be in such a comfortable place. You know, I have internet that works. Some of us who travel in Africa realize what a premium that is in certain parts of the world. Wow, I've got to quickly send these emails because I might have a few minutes of internet. Here I've got internet all day long. I can walk over to the Starbucks and buy, I don't because it's too big and expensive, but I could buy a cup of coffee, sit and enjoy the afternoon, pray about some things, write some things, plenty of things I could have been doing rather than complaining and murmuring. So we see that part of this sin is simply a lack of faith in God, not believing that God really has our best interest in heart. And let's look at one more aspect, actually two, since we're on number six. These will go quickly. Complaining at number six often happens in private. Remember we read earlier, where did Israel grumble? We read it. They grumbled in their tents. When the Pharisees were grumbling at Christ for eating with the tax collectors, did they go to Christ and say, we're really concerned about this. You seem to be neglecting a certain principle of the law, staying away from the unclean. No, they grumbled to the disciples. Often grumbling, again, it's not solution-oriented. This is why so much grumbling, so much murmuring, so much complaining takes place on the internet. Because I don't have to face the person. You might remember one very popular talk show radio dude. He's since left the scene. But he was on for years and never once had a guest on his show. Especially one of an opposing attitude. Because then you can't paint the picture that you want to paint. But you see, if you never have to face the individual that you're complaining about or that you're talking about, you never have to justify your own position. You just paint the way you want. You set up that straw man and continually knock him down time after time after time. And that straw man may not even exist. Because if you have to look someone in the eye and sit down face to face, would we say the same things? Probably not. Notice Psalm 106. Psalm 106. It's easy to take swipes at others, to grumble about them, to complain about them in private, away from the supposed source that's giving us this complaint, a reason to complain. Psalm 106 in verse 21. Let's go back to verse 19 to show that we're in the context of Israel and what they did in the wilderness. They made a calf in Horeb. So David in this song is rehearsing some of the same things that Paul wrote about in 1 Corinthians 10. They made a calf in Horeb and worshipped the molded image. And they changed their glory, meaning God, into the image of an ox that eats grass. And David, it's almost a humorous line. Are you serious, he's saying? They took God's powerful image and made it into a cow that eats grass. Can you believe it? That's what, in essence, what he's saying. But verse 21, they forgot God, their Savior, who had done great things in Egypt, wondrous works in the land of Ham, awesome things by the Red Sea. Therefore, he said that he would destroy them had not Moses, his chosen one, stood before him in the breach to turn away his wrath, lest he destroy them. They despised then the pleasant land. They did not believe his word. Notice the connection again. Not believing God, verse 25, but complained in their tents, did not heed the voice of the Eternal. Therefore, he raised his hand in an oath against them to overthrow them in the wilderness. So grumbling and complaining usually happens in private, away from the source, among others who can do nothing about the addressed problem or the problem that needs to be addressed. They grumbled in their tents. It's pretty difficult to work with someone through a challenge, through a disagreement. Easier to complain about them, against them, in private, away from them. Not a Christian thing to do. Last but not least, number 7, grumbling, complaining, murmuring is opposite of God's nature. We read earlier, do all things without murmuring or grumbling and complaining and arguing, so that we can become blameless and harmless children of God. Turn to Psalm 103, just a few pages over. Psalm 103. The complainer does not give help. The complainer does not work toward a solution. The grumbler, instead of building relationships, harms them, poisons others against the supposed problem, the one who's causing the problem. Bad feelings abound. Relationships can be harmed, if not destroyed, by grumbling and complaining. No wonder God says, do all things without complaining and arguing. Psalm 103 and verse 11. For as heavens are high above the earth, so great is his mercy toward those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. As a father pities, that means cares for, has a heart for his children, so the Eternal has a heart or pities those who fear him. For he knows our frame, we are but dust. That's God's nature. Tremendously merciful. Not complaining. If God had something to complain about, couldn't he complain about me? Couldn't he complain about you? Look, I called this guy 42 years ago, set him up in the perfect situation, and he's still sinning. Can you believe that? Could be said about any of us, I suppose. God's not a complainer. He's saying, look how far my son, my daughter, has come. Keep it up. Let's encourage them. Let's work with them. So how do we combat, as we close, how do we combat complaining and murmuring? How do we turn that into something different? Well, I give 5 quick suggestions. Simple sentences to think about, to meditate, to pray about. Number 1, deliberately speak well of others. Deliberately speak well of others. That's the opposite of grumbling and complaining about others. But specifically, speak deliberately well of others. Not just when something comes up, but when things aren't going well. And someone says something about another, and you can say, well, I don't know if that's true, but this I do know. And you can say something positive, something well. Speak well of others. When you have the opportunity, encourage others away from them. Not just to them directly, but away from them as well. Number two, search for what is right and good. Search for what is right and good. Last week when I gave this sermon in Indianapolis, one of the fellas said, I just think of that old song about, he tried to recall the lyrics. Didn't do a real good job of recalling the lyrics, but it was something about, you know, be positive and don't go for mystery in between. So for all the trivia folks, you can remember that song? Eliminate the negative. It says, nonetheless, look for, search for what is right and good. That's when Ephesians or Philippians 4 says to focus our mind, to think on those things. We have an obligation when things are lousy to make sure we're looking for what is good and what is right. So in 103 degree temperature in Texas, can you be thankful for a dry fit shirt? Yeah, what a nice shirt this is. We're sweating right through it, but what a nice shirt. Can we think about those things? Absolutely. Number three, speak the benefit of the doubt. Say it out loud. If someone has misbehaved, done something wrong, can we speak out loud the benefit of the doubt? Someone complains to you about someone else, can we speak to them the benefit of the doubt? Hey, maybe they're just having a rough day. Maybe they're just having a rough life. I'll tell you what, let's both be sure to pray about that this coming week. Can we speak the benefit of the doubt? Absolutely. That helps our mind to focus a little bit. Now, last but not least, how to combat complaining and murmuring. Go to your brother. Go to your sister. If we're tempted to say something about someone away from them that is a complaint or a grumble or a murmur, take it to the source. Go to your brother or your sister. Now, there's two scriptures we have to read as we close, because this is the fifth of five sermons that talk about the capital sins of Israel. Psalm 78 is another one of David's, I think there's Asaph's psalm. Let me look at the title, I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah, one of Asaph's psalms. Asaph was one of the head musicians among the Levites. Psalm 78, verse 40, he's likewise writing about the history of Israel. And he says something critically important in Psalm 78 in verse 40. It says, how often they provoked him, meaning God, they rebelled against him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. Yes, again and again they tempted God. We knew that from last time. But then it says this, and limited the Holy One of Israel. These capital sins all have in common limiting God. Assuming that God cannot do what he said he will do. Assuming that God is not whom he said he is. Assuming that we are the center of the universe, not God. They limit God. We cannot do so. So whether it's lusting, whether it's tempting Christ, you know, whether it's sexual immorality, whether it's idolatry, all these things are limits on the great God, who he is. So let's go back to 1 Corinthians 10, where we began this series of sermons. I said we'd eventually be back to it. It's the first scripture, and it's the last of the sermon. 1 Corinthians 10, we've gone through these things. Verse 10, nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Then Paul reemphasized, now all these things happen to them as examples. And they were written, not for a history book, they were written for our admonition. Other translations render that our instruction. That's why these things were recorded. They were recorded for our admonition, our instruction, upon whom the end of the ages have come. That's for us today. And then he says in verse 12, and verse 12 is the summary of this section. Therefore, as a result of learning these things, these capital sins of Israel, therefore, Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. That's Paul's final instruction after going through this. You think you're doing okay? Let's review these sins, see where we stand. If we think we stand, great, but take heed to be consistent, to keep going, to not fall by the wayside as Israel did. So, brethren, we have the benefit of the record of Israel's five capital sins. Let's do all we can to reverse them and prepare to enter the true promised land, the coming kingdom of God.